But just as Manley was about to call Oppenheimer in Los Alamos, Groves stopped him. No one was to disseminate any information about the atomic bombing until the president himself announced it. Frustrated, Manley went for a midnight walk in Lafayette Park across from the White House. Early the next morning, he was told that Truman would make an announcement at 11 a.m. Manley finally got Oppie on the phone just as the president's statement was released on nationwide radio. Although they had agreed to use a prearranged code for conveying the news over the phone, Oppenheimer's first words to Manley were, "Why the hell do you think I sent you to Washington in the first place?" That same day, at 2 p.m., General Groves picked up the phone in Washington and called Oppenheimer in Los Alamos. Groves was in a congratulatory mood. "I'm proud of you and all of your people," Groves said. "It went all right?" Oppie asked. "Apparently it went with a tremendous bang." "Everybody is feeling reasonably good about it," Oppie said, "and I extend my heartiest congratulations. It's been a long road." "Yes," Groves replied. "It has been a long road, and I think one of the wisest things I ever did was when I selected the director of Los Alamos." "Well," replied Oppenheimer diffidently, "I have my doubts, General Groves." Groves replied, "Well, you know I've never concurred with those doubts at any time." Later in the day, the news was announced over the Los Alamos public address system. "Attention, please! Attention, please! One of our units has just been successfully dropped on Japan." Frank Oppenheimer was standing in the hallway right outside his brother's office when he heard the news. His first reaction was, "Thank God it wasn't a dud." But within seconds, he recalled, one suddenly got this horror of all the people that had been killed. A soldier, Ed Doty, described the scene for his parents in a letter he wrote the next day. "This last 24 hours has been quite exciting. Everyone has been keyed up to a pitch higher than anything I have ever seen on such a mass scale before. People came out into the hallways of the building and milled around like a Times Square New Year's crowd. Everyone was looking for a radio." That evening, a crowd gathered in an auditorium. One of the younger physicists, Sam Cohen, remembers a cheering, foot-stamping audience waiting for Oppenheimer to appear. Everyone expected him to come on stage from the auditorium wings, as was his custom, but Oppenheimer chose to make a more dramatic entrance from the rear, making his way up the center aisle. Once on stage, according to Cohen, he clasped his hands together and pumped them over his head like a prize fighter. Cohen remembers Oppie telling the cheering crowd that it was too early to determine what the results of the bombing might have been, but he was sure that the Japanese didn't like it. The crowd cheered and then roared its approval when Oppie said he was proud of what they had accomplished. By Cohen's account, Oppenheimer's, only regret was that we hadn't developed the bomb in time to have used it against the Germans. This practically raised the roof. It was as if he had been called upon to act out a stage role, one to which he was truly not suited. Scientists are not meant to be conquering generals. And yet, he was only human, and so must have felt the thrill of pure success. He had grabbed a metaphorical gold ring, and he was happily waving it aloft. Besides, the audience expected him to appear flushed and triumphant. But the moment was short-lived. For some who had just seen and felt the blinding light and blasting wind of the explosion at Alamogordo, the expected news from the Pacific was something of an anticlimax. It was almost as if Alamogordo had drained their capacity for astonishment. Others were merely sobered by the news. Phil Morrison heard the news on Tinian, where he had helped to prepare the bomb and load it aboard the Enola Gay. "That night we from Los Alamos had a party," Morrison recalled. "It was war and victory in war, and we had a right to our celebration. But I remember sitting on the edge of a cot, wondering what it was like on the other side. What was going on in Hiroshima that night?" Alice Kimball Smith later insisted that certainly no one at Los Alamos celebrated Hiroshima. But then she admitted that a few people tried to assemble a party in the men's dormitories. It turned into a memorable fiasco. People either stayed away or beat a hasty retreat. Smith, to be sure, was referring only to the scientists, who appear to have had a decidedly muted and different reaction than the military enlisted men. Doty wrote home, "There were parties galore. Invited to three of them, I managed to get to only one. It lasted until three." He reported that people were happy, very happy. "We listened to the radio and danced and listened to the radio again, and laughed at all that was said." Oppenheimer attended one party, but upon leaving, he saw a clearly distraught physicist retching his guts out in the bushes. The sight made him realize that an accounting had begun. Robert Wilson had been horrified by the news from Hiroshima. He had never wanted the weapon to be used, and thought he had grounds for believing it would not be. In January, Oppenheimer had persuaded him to continue his work, but only so that the bomb could be demonstrated. And Oppenheimer, he knew, had participated in the interim committee's deliberations. Rationally, he understood that Oppie had been in no position to make him any firm promises, that this was a decision for the generals, Secretary of War Stimson, and, ultimately, the president. But he nevertheless felt his trust had been abused. "I felt betrayed," Wilson wrote in 1958. "When the bomb was exploded over Japan without discussion or some peaceful demonstration of its power to the Japanese." Wilson's wife, Jane, happened to be visiting San Francisco when she heard the news about Hiroshima. Rushing back to Los Alamos, she greeted her husband with congratulatory smiles, only to find him very depressed, she said. And then, 3 days later, another bomb devastated Nagasaki. "People were going around banging garbage can covers and so on," Jane Wilson recalled. "And he wouldn't join in. He was sulking and unhappy." Bob Wilson recalled, "I remember being just ill, sick to the point that I thought I would be, you know, vomit." Wilson was not alone. "As the days passed," wrote Alice Kimball Smith, the wife of the Los Alamos metallurgist Cyril Smith, "the revulsion grew, bringing with it, even for those who believe that the end of the war justified the bombing, an intensely personal experience of the reality of evil."